Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a project funded by the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today we're discussing the two main approaches to philosophy and the animosity that results from their differences. Our guest is philosopher Gary Gutting. Thank you for joining us in our discussion. I often wonder what philosophy looks like from the outside. I'm immersed in it, so it seems normal to me. But I know that for most people, our vocabulary is technical, and our way of doing things is foreign. There are times when the whole project seems incomprehensible. So it's my job to present philosophy in such a way that it makes sense, and the easiest way to do this is to portray it as one conversation with many participants all aiming for the same goal, wisdom, truth, understanding. Then I can claim that even those who disagree with one another are asking the same questions and learning from each other. But this version is a lie. There really isn't one thing called philosophy, and there isn't a singular discussion among equals who speak a common language. Instead, philosophy is a collection of ideas, inquiries, methods, and texts, many of which communicate in radically different ways. Art and literature can be philosophy, so can math, science, and economics. And while philosophers like to claim that these all interact in some obvious way, the fact is that philosophy can be described by focusing on the discontinuities, the breaks in the discussion, the confusions and the dead ends, just as easily as it can be described by focusing on its progress. Today's episode is about these fissures. It's about emphasizing the philosophies that don't work together and the confusion that results. We'll be able to look at it, not only the different answers, but the different questions and the methods for talking about each of them. For some, philosophy is about clarifying language, making things as simple as possible, and refining terminology. But for others, philosophy is about emphasizing complexity, how hard it is to understand things, and the impossibility of communication or learning the truth. I'm going to use an odd example to explain what I mean. I'm from New York City. My wife is from North Carolina. Southerners tend to think of New Yorkers as brusque and rude. New Yorkers tend to think of Southerners as slow and formal. But the fact is that both have their own ways of doing the same thing. Imagine that I'm ordering a pizza in Manhattan. I'd walk up to the counter and say, "Yeah, let me get a slice." Then while the person was getting me the pizza, I would make a joke. He or she would joke back. We'd chat. I'd get the pizza, pay, and then leave. In the South, however, I would walk to the counter, say hello, make small talk first, then ask for the slice, pay, and be on my way. In both, there's the social interaction, a request, and a payment. But they are in the opposite order. So if a New Yorker were to go South and just ask for the slice of pizza, he or she would seem incredibly rude. If the Southerner in New York were to engage in small talk first, everyone would get impatient. No one's trying to be difficult, but these differences lead to frustration, hostility, and even hatred. So how do we deal with this philosophically? Well, we could break it down analytically the way I just did, show how each interaction has the same parts and count on people to convince themselves that no one is being rude. But this doesn't give enough attention to the experience, and it doesn't describe the complexity of community. So we could take the opposite approach and focus on the phenomenon of ordering pizza by emphasizing people's miscommunication and alienation. But while this reports the almost literary quality of the events, it leaves us floundering without resolution. There may be no satisfying way to both account for the authentic frustration and explain away the confusion. And this problem illustrates the deepest debate in contemporary philosophy. Do we analyze a problem away, or do we celebrate its unending complexity? When I report that some philosophers have grown to hate one another because of this, I am not exaggerating. Today we'll focus on the fact that philosophy, like life, is fragmented and conflicted. It won't be an easy discussion, but I would argue that this isn't just a philosopher's debate. It's everyone's. It's a discussion about culture wars, relativism, and the search for truth. This may seem a long way from ordering a pizza, but the simple things are often the hardest. So, as it will turn out, is communicating about them. And now our guest. Gary Gutting holds the Notre Dame Chair in Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. He writes for both general and specialized audiences. His most recent work includes books on French philosophy and pieces in the New York Times philosophy blog, The Stone. Gary, thank you for joining us on Why.
I'm happy to be here.
So, Gary, what is philosophy supposed to do?
Well, I think the first thing to get clear about is that it's not something we ought to expect to answer the big questions. Does God exist? Are we free? Is there life after death? I mean, I agree that historically, and even to the present time, that's the ultimate goal of philosophers. But as anybody who encounters philosophy for even a little bit realizes quite quickly, there's no agreement on those sorts of big questions among philosophers. So you can't get up in front of a classroom, for example, and say, here is philosophy's answer to the question, does God exist? Is there life after death? And so on. I think a much better way to think about it is this. You come to philosophy with your own basic overall picture of things. I mean, maybe you're a devoted churchgoer and a liberal Democrat, or you're an atheistic materialist and a socialist revolutionary, whatever. Lots of different kind of basic worldviews people can have. What philosophy does for this ordinary person who's thoughtful is give you the tools to understand your commitments, to develop them, and maybe even radically revise them. So I'd put it this way. Philosophy should not think of as something that is supposed to give you a worldview. You already have a worldview. What philosophy does is give you the means to provide what I like to call intellectual maintenance for your worldview. If you want an analogy, it's not quite pizzas, but it's that philosophy is not a car dealership, it's a service department.
Now, I think that some of our listeners are already reeling from this in the sense that they're thinking, well, but I thought the whole point was to tell us what's true, to tell us what's real. I mean, isn't there a long history of people trying to prove that God exists? If philosophy isn't doing that stuff, were these people not philosophers?
No, you're a philosopher if you're trying to do that. That's right. That's the goal. And I'd be delighted if some morning somebody comes up and I find on my email a absolutely decisive proof for God's existence, or a decisive proof that a certain way of living is the greatest human good, or something like that. And we've got to be open to that. Could happen. But we've had 2,500 years of history that suggests that, shows it has not happened yet, and suggests that it's not very likely to happen anytime soon. So it isn't that I'm saying that the ultimate goal of philosophy isn't to answer these ultimate questions. That's what it is. That's what we keep trying to do. But what I'm saying is, for any ordinary person who wants to make use of philosophical results, there are important philosophical results that you can use even though they don't give you answers to those questions. We can't expect philosophy to just wipe the slate clean, the way Descartes, for instance, talked about, and start from nothing and build up the right answers. We start with a lot of views that we already have in the world, and we need to think about them, need to think about them clearly, cogently, sensitively. Philosophers have got, in fact, they have discovered, they have developed the tools that we need to do that.
You're talking about the description of our own worldview, and the word that pops into my head is narcissism. Is that not just us describing ourselves and focusing on ourselves and not focusing on, I think Russell called it the not self, right? Isn't what you're describing just a form of self-portraiture?
Yeah, I don't think that's right. Certainly there is, they sometimes use the fancy word, the egocentric predicament. That is, my beliefs are my beliefs, right? I believe what I believe. But what I believe is typically not about me or even about my beliefs. It's about the world. Now, sure, it's the world as I, all things considered, see it, as what my experience gives me to think about it. But it is objective in the sense of it's directed outside of me to a world that's not me. So, no, it's not that I'm just saying what I think. Another way to put it is this. I say things, but when I say them, they're not being expressed simply as my opinion, at least not when we're doing philosophy. It's being expressed, what I say is being expressed as a view that I'm prepared to defend to all comers, to anyone who wants to talk to me about it, who wants to argue about it. This notion that you have, that philosophy is people talking to one another. There's a kind of a conversation that's been going on ever since who knows when Thales fell into his well or whatever. And That's what it is. So it's a public enterprise. You're giving reasons, you're giving justifications, you're doing things that other people can relate to. So it's not narcissism.
So philosophy really for you is connected to day-to-day life. It's really a mechanism for us to investigate ourselves and other people, and it's not simply a ivory tower, navel-gazing enterprise, but it's really about creating tools to talk to others about ourselves and others in the world we inhabit.
Yeah, talk to others and to ourselves, right. I mean, the point is that I think the mistake, in fact, one place I wrote, I called it the philosopher's fallacy, because I think philosophers have often made it, is to think that people don't have a right to fundamental beliefs about God or ethics or political theories unless they're justified by some thoroughgoing, well-thought-out philosophical theory. Well, if that were true, then nobody'd be entitled to any beliefs that they've got. You wouldn't even be entitled to believe that, say, other people existed or that you existed. You don't have to prove those things philosophically to be entitled to have a view about them. So we all start with views that we have. And what those views require, though, since we're thinking skeptical, doubtful, always experiencing people, is some kind of intellectual maintenance, some way to work on them to see what they really mean, whether they're self-consistent, whether they can be defended to other people. And that's what philosophy has developed over 2,500 years, has developed tools for doing that sort of thing.
And is it always clear, or let me rephrase that, does everyone agree on what counts as philosophy and what doesn't? I mean, biologists seem to have a clear sense of what biology is, and architects seem to have a sense of what architecture is. Do philosophers have that same kind of certainty?
Well, it's often said, and I think there's a certain truth to it, that philosophy is questioning, in contrast to almost every other kind, that is completely no holds barred, right? There aren't any questions you can't ask in philosophy. So if you push a physicist or a biologist or a theologian a certain distance, at some point those people in those other disciplines are going to say, well, I'm sorry, that's just how we do it in this discipline. In philosophy, you can always ask, why do we do it? What's happening? So, yeah, for that reason, philosophy itself is a question for itself in a way that's not so for other disciplines. I think that's right. That's because philosophy just insists on raising questions about anything that comes up. It doesn't want to define its domain in a certain way. It just says, well, yeah, either do it this way or get out of here.
Now, I'm an American philosopher. You're an American philosopher. You work in French philosophy, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
Would the French colleagues that you interact with have the same view of philosophy as you? Is American philosophy the same vision as French philosophy or even German or Spanish or mm-hmm. what have you?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of different philosophizing. And if you just put it in those geographical sorts of terms, sure, there are a lot of people in France, in Germany, in all parts of Europe, in Asia, every over the world, who operate pretty much the way philosophers at the dominant universities in the United States, philosophy departments operate. That's true. But even in the United States, there are people who have a quite different view from the view that is the dominant one, the one that's often called analytic philosophy, the kind of philosophy you will learn at most of the major universities in the United States. That's quite different than what goes on in a lot of the places in Europe. But there are also places in the United States that do a very different style of philosophy.
And so there's this other thing, this other animal that's named after Europe. It's called continental philosophy.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
In the profession, and we're going to go back to the question of whether it's just a professional debate in a second, in the profession there is this hostility between these people that they call themselves the analytic and the people they call themselves the continentals. What does continental philosophy look like? And if people listening to this show, particularly our long-term listeners, are used to us doing this analysis, how would it sound if we were to shift and enter this continental way of being?
Yeah. First thing to say is kind of a preliminary, and I don't mean to avoid your question. There is a real oddness about talking about a big division between analytic and continental philosophy. And nowadays in particular, almost everybody who starts discussing this begins by saying, well, it's a crazy distinction. It doesn't make any sense. There really is no good distinction like that. But then in 2 or 3 minutes, they fall back on using the distinction. The reason it's an odd distinction, first of all, is that it, if you think about it, is contrasting a geographical characterization of philosophy that's done in the European continent, with what you might call a methodological one, philosophy done by analysis. An important recently deceased philosopher, Bernard Williams, nicely pointed out that that's a weird thing to do, to divide it that way. It's like saying there are two kinds of cars, four-wheel drive ones and ones that are made in Japan. The categories don't fit together. So it's not the best way to talk about things. The problem is this. It's fairly easy to say what analytic philosophy, at least nowadays, is, because it's a pretty generic, straightforward thing. It's a kind of philosophy that has a high emphasis on careful analysis of concepts and of language, and especially on very logically rigorous argument for its conclusions. That doesn't mean it can get very complicated and can be hard to understand, but it's because of the complexity of the ideas. The goal is always logical clarity and rigor in argument. Now, if you want to make what the contrast term is, so-called continental philosophy, the truth of the matter, as a lot of people have emphasized recently, is that there are many, many different kinds of continental philosophy. And you're not going to get useful comparisons unless you limit yourself to a particular variety of continental. It's not so bad to talk about analytic on this methodological level in a general sort of way that gives it a single characterization. That simply doesn't work for so-called continental. So, for example,
Gary, can I interrupt for just a second? Because this is going to get really complicated really quickly. The thing that pops into my head right now is the red state, blue state division. Anyone who's serious about politics knows that the red state, blue state thing doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, North Dakota, where I'm broadcasting from right now, I know that people are going to be surprised when I say this, but I argue all the time that North Dakota is the most socialist state in the union, yet it is regarded as solidly red. As Americans, at least, we are really used to these sort of artificial descriptions. Is the continental analytic debate sort of analogous, as simplistic as the red state, blue state, or does it represent a real substantial distinction?
I think a lot of people use it as a simplistic distinction. As Brian Leiter, a very good philosopher that I think you've had on your show before, pointed out, he said that a lot of times what people use the distinction for, philosophers use it for, is to excuse themselves from having to read a bunch of literature that they're not interested in reading. So I can say, oh, I'm an analytic philosopher, so I don't read these things written by these Germans and French people.
And I'm a blue state person, so I don't watch Fox News.
Exactly. And the other way around, there's a lot of continental people that just say, yeah, well, that's that stupid analytic philosophy. It's narrow, logic chopping. I'm not interested in that. So, yeah, it can be used in a nice way analogous to your political distinction. I think that's a nice comparison. But if you want to get deeper into understanding what's really going on with the philosophy, what I really think you have to do is focus on particular versions of the so-called continental philosophy. Particularly, you had already mentioned the kind of stuff I've worked on in some recent years, the kind of philosophy that's been going on in France, particularly in France since 1960 or so. That's got a distinctive kind of characteristic to it. You can talk about that and compare it and contrast it, interestingly, I think, with analytic philosophy. Now, you can do the same thing with, say, analytic philosophy and existentialist philosophy, which a lot of people have studied, you know, in college courses. And there's Marxist philosophy. There's lots of other kinds of continental philosophy. But a fruitful discussion that isn't going to just get stuck in that red state, blue state sort of thing is going to be one that focuses on particular type of continental philosophy.
Now, before we advance in particular details, we got a question from Tony, who's a grad student in New York City. And the question was almost snippish, although I love the question. The question is really, you know, isn't the problem that philosophers are concerned with distinctions like analytic and continental and not concerned with questions of justice and other such things, that focusing on this kind of professional debate is almost a waste of time? And so the question I have, even before we proceed, is, are we engaged in just a debate between specialists, or are there ramifications for this debate for everybody in their day-to-day lives?
Yeah, it's not just a specialist debate at all. Of course, it's very important to say to talk about justice. As a matter of fact, philosophers on both sides of the continental divide, so to speak, talk a lot about justice. John Rawls is an analytic philosopher, written a major book about justice that has had huge influence, and quite concrete influence, on contemporary political discussions. Jacques Derrida, the great French post-structuralist, deconstructionist, some of his most interesting work is about justice. Philosophy always is interested, or for a long time, and certainly currently now, is very interested in these what you might call first-order questions about what do we do in the world, how do we live, and so on. But, after all, if you are working, I guess I think about it this way, it's like raising Tony's objection strikes me as like saying, hey, why is that carpenter wasting his time sharpening his tools? Why does he get the saw sharpened? Why does he make sure his hammer's head is on properly? The thing to do is get out there and start building the house, right? Well, you can't build the house unless your tools are in good shape. And discussions at this so-called meta level about what is philosophy, what methods do we use, how do we use them, how are they best employed, is exactly that kind of concern. Sometimes, not all the time, you start doing nothing but sharpening your saw, you're not going to build any houses. But there's absolutely essential room for a moment, or moments every day, where you take care of that kind of basic maintenance.
We're going to take a break in just a minute, but I want to ask you, is there a part of you, I'll say this romantically, is there a part of your soul that continental approaches, the sort of the less analytic approaches, speaks to? And is there a part of you that the analytic approach speaks to? Do these different philosophies speak to different parts of people? Or are there really just like analytic people and continental people?
There certainly are analytic people and there are continental people. I know, for instance, people who, as soon as they see numbered propositions in a text of philosophy, will throw it on the ground and say, I have nothing to do with it there. They think it's somehow destroying the poetry of it. And on the other hand, there are people who read three lines of Heidegger or Sartre and just say, my God, this is absolutely ridiculous. It's a matter of intellectual hygiene, if someone has said, that we not read this kind of stuff. But I do think for many, many of us, there are two sides to us that are alternatively called to one or the other way of doing philosophy. Often people have thought, oh, there's got to be some way to put it together. I'm not sure anymore that there is a way to put it together, but I think you're right. There might just be two different aspects of our soul that we somehow have to deal with.
When we come back, we're going to look at more examples of this and try to get a better sense of what exactly we're talking about. Post questions at facebook.com/whyradioshow or email us at askwhy@und.edu. You're listening to Gary Gutting and Jack Russell Weinstein. We'll be back after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Gary Gutting about how to do philosophy and the different philosophical schools of thought. Feel free to participate in our chat room at whyradioshow.org or write us at askwhy@und.edu. I'm going to talk about some ancient history for our younger listeners, but I was just finishing a book about the President Clinton-Monica Lewinsky scandal. Jeffrey Toobin, a wonderful legal scholar, wrote this book called The Vast Conspiracy. And there's this very famous moment when President Clinton is being questioned about his affair with this intern. And he's asked if he had if he lied under oath, and he said, "It depends what the meaning of is." And the whole debate is about the meaning of sex and this meaning of this term. And people didn't find that very satisfying. People weren't particularly bothered, actually. His poll numbers stayed constant throughout the whole thing. But people didn't find that satisfying. And there was a couple reasons why. But one of the reasons is that people felt that sex is something that you lie about. And that if you're going to lie to your wife about having an affair, of course you're going to lie to a lawyer. And of course you're going to lie to the general public. It's just something you do. When you listen to this debate, you have to ask yourself, how satisfying are these detailed-oriented, logic-crunching analyses, and do they ever change anyone's minds? And in the back of this whole discussion is this question that we have to ask ourselves whether or not it's possible to change someone's mind. Now, as we come back, I want to bring another very famous logic-crunching example to the fore. Gary, I know you're familiar with Nietzsche. There is a famous line in Nietzsche: truth is a lie. Nietzsche's character Zarathustra comes down from the mountains to talk to the general public, and he says that he wants to announce that truth is a lie. And there are a lot of philosophers who think that doesn't make any sense at all, because if truth is a lie and that statement is true, then the statement is a lie. But if it's a lie, then we don't have to listen to it. That's not very satisfying. Can a different approach to philosophy makes sense of this proposition, truth is a lie?
Yeah, I think there would be ways to make sense of it. You can talk in terms of different frameworks of thought, and you could talk about what's true within one framework. Say, for instance, a particular system of physics, right? You could say talk in terms of the physics that Newton invented in the 17th century and that physicists used for several centuries after that. And then you could say, well, I could talk about what's true in the framework of that kind of physics. But then you could say, well, you know, in the 20th century, we discovered that really that framework in the end is not completely adequate. It's not completely accurate. And so the framework itself is false. So that although there are certain things that are true within that framework, that all the truths of that framework are lies, or like, if you like, if false. So you can do certain kinds of conceptual analysis that will make sense of some meanings for a statement like that. That's one thing you can do. Now, there's another dimension I can talk about, but at least that's a first start.
We have a question from Sam in Grand Forks, and I think it relates to this. And the question is, are there connections between philosophy and myth? And this also connects to something I wanted to talk about with you about the role of literature in philosophy. So Nietzsche tells a story. We have a character who says this thing that is very imprecise but also tremendously powerful. We have these great works of philosophy, whether it's their biblical literature or Sartre's No Exit or Dostoevsky's work or even just sitcoms and things like that. Continental philosophy often talks about aesthetics and beauty and literature. There's a role that literature plays in this kind of philosophy that it doesn't necessarily play in this thing that we're calling the analytic tradition. What does literature, what does poetry, what does myth offer that a more logic-oriented approach to argument doesn't give us?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. I do think it's true that you can do philosophy in a literary way. I think writers like Dostoevsky and T.S. Eliot give literary treatments of philosophical questions. It's hard to read them without having those questions come up and even think that there's in some sense responses being given to them. And certainly philosophers like Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, and existentialist writers like Albert Camus have put forward philosophical ideas in literary form. Now, I think there are two big differences, though, between a literary treatment of a philosophical question and a more standard professional disciplinary treatment that you might call a theoretical treatment. When you're working in a literary way, the treatment is often centered on concrete examples, maybe fictional, but maybe not. And the treatment doesn't explicitly say anything about how, if at all, we're supposed to generalize from those examples. So if you read Camus' novel, The Stranger, his main character, Meursault, raises all sorts of questions about the absurdity of life and the meaningfulness of existence. It's not clear how we're supposed to generalize from that. The second thing, though, is that a literary treatment often, and this is especially important for the analytic continental distinction, a literary treatment will often not be concerned to eliminate conceptual tensions, that is, apparent contradictions, paradoxes, questions like, are Oedipus's actions in Sophocles' play, are they free or are they determined? That doesn't get an explicit answer. The literary philosopher is more concerned with completeness and subtlety of treatment. The theoretical philosopher, if I can use the term, is more concerned with logical clarity and consistency. So I do think you can approach things in a literary way and do philosophical work, but it is got a different kind of concerns. And especially, I think, when you come to contemporary French philosophy, it has a literary character to it, particularly because of the almost deliberate attempt not to eliminate the paradoxes and apparent contradictions, but to intensify them. And I think that's where a lot of the conflict between analytic and continental comes from.
I love this phrase, conceptual tension. And this, too, is this tremendous connection between the discussion we're having and our day-to-day lives, because how people deal with conceptual tensions really reflects a whole range of things about them. I mean, there are many very religious Christians who regard the Gospels as truth, but the Gospels all have different endings, and one of the Gospels has three different endings. And so if you were to look at this analytically, you would say it doesn't make sense. But if you look at it from the conceptual tension, all of a sudden you start learning things by looking at the difference. Every marriage, every relationship has tensions because you want to remain loyal to yourself and to the principles of the marriage, but there's always compromises is the word. That should have come easier to me as a married man. And all of these things. And so the concept of conceptual tension, would you – I mean, this is a prescription, but do you think that the people around you, do you think that the philosophers, but also the non-philosophers and the politicians, do you think that we do a good job of dealing with this kind of conceptual tension? And if we spent more time thinking about – literature as philosophy and continental philosophy, would we do a better job of dealing with conceptual tension?
Yeah, and I don't know if it's so much thinking about philosophy and thinking about literature as just involving ourselves in philosophical thinking and in literary appreciation and so on. I think that can help a great deal. Sometimes it's not just a matter of compromising. I think you were right to hesitate there. You take the marriage analogy. I'm very impressed with someone who one time said, you know, sometimes having a good marriage is mainly a matter of just not saying something a couple times a day. So sometimes it's silence that you need. That is, let the tension or the contradiction hang there for a while and don't try to clear it up. Don't try to get to the bottom of it and find out who was at fault or who wasn't at fault. And sometimes that's a proper answer, and that's a very poetic or a literary answer. That is, you just juxtapose the contradictions and let them be there. Now, granted, analytic philosophers don't do that, and the drive of philosophy for a long time has been not to do that. And certainly there's a lot to be gained by trying to dig down to the root of the contradictions and to resolve them. But sometimes it's more important to maintain the tension, because each side of the tension has a certain grasp on truth, and if you try to eliminate the tension, you're going to eliminate a certain aspect of the truth.
And there are, of course, other kinds of tension that we really revel in, and what pops into my head is sexual tension, that if there is sexual tension between people and they try to resolve the sexual tension immediately, the flirting goes away, the excitement goes away, and all that sort of stuff.
That's right.
Now, our listeners are going to want some sort of really concrete example of the kind of thing that we're talking about. And so I'm going to ask a sort of very straightforward question here. There's this term and there's this approach to philosophy called phenomenology. And that's sort of – that's one of the classical continental approaches. What is phenomenology and what's so appealing about it?
I think the big thing that was always appealing about phenomenology was the idea, look, let's try to solve our philosophical questions, not by theoretical discussion, not by abstract argument, but by simply giving an immediate description of the way things are in what the phenomenologists like to call our lived experience. Sartre is probably the best philosopher for this, Heidegger also, but he can be a little complex on the terminology. Sartre sits us down and says, let's look at a couple in a cafe who are, you were just talking about flirting, they're essentially flirting, okay? So he has this famous passage where he says, let's consider the case of a woman who has agreed to go out with a man for the first time. And then he gives this great concrete description in philosophical terms, but it's supposed to give you the lived experience of what it's like to be a woman who's sitting in a cafe with a guy, knowing that the guy is primarily interested in you as a sexual object, wanting the attention that you get as a sexual object, but at the same time wanting to not commit yourself to a sexual relationship with the guy. So he has this very detailed, concrete description of that experience that I think anybody who's gotten through adolescence can relate to. But he makes great philosophy out of it. So there's a really good example, I think.
But that really sounds like literature. So what's the philosophical power that you get from the description, or do you just get a scene that you think, well, that's very interesting, and I can watch it, I can live in it. What do you get out of it philosophically?
Yeah. Well, it does sound like literature when I describe it that way, and when Sartre introduces it, it gets us because it has a literary aspect. But remember, it's a paragraph in the middle of a 700-page treatise called Being and Nothingness, right? And it's loaded with philosophical jargon. And in fact, after he gives this very well-done literary description of a phenomenon he's going to call self-deception or bad faith, how the woman both believes and doesn't believe that she's a sexual object for this man, he then says, now, what makes it possible? What makes it possible for her to experience herself this way? And then suddenly hits us with a line of something like, well, it's possible because she is a being who is what she is in the mode of not being it. And suddenly, boom, you go from the literature to the philosophy and then start thinking about these weird, apparently contradictory ideas. What does it mean to say that I am not what I am and I am what I am not and so forth?
And this actually speaks to Jamie's question. She's from Minot. Is there a philosophy that mixes analytic and continental elements? And what also strikes me, because we're always trying to emphasize how these questions deal with day-to-day life, that this notion of bad faith and honestly being who you are to yourself and to others and authenticity, this is largely what the debate on the Republican side of politics is right now. Is Romney acting in bad faith? Is he inauthentic? Mm-hmm. Is he a real conservative, or is he not a real conservative? And should real conservatives trust him? This is a Sartrean problem, right? This is the question. Is this person who he appears to be, not only in terms of the audience listening to him and making decisions, but does Romney know enough about himself to know if he himself is who he claims to be?
Yeah, no, that's right. It's what Sartre in the end calls the question of authenticity, right? Authenticity, being who you are and so on. And I think this is a good example because the example is something that comes up all the time. Not only so much am I lying to other people, but am I lying to myself, right? This is what bad faith is for Sartre. It's lying to myself. And the reason Sartre's interesting is not only because he can describe this phenomenon with a lot of nuance and specificity, but because he's got a very interesting philosophical angle on interpreting the phenomenon, because what he wants to say is, look, the thing about being a human being, as opposed to, say, being a lamp or a tree or a rock, is that there isn't anything that a human being is. We're free creatures, and because of that, we can think of ourselves in a variety of different ways. There is no pre-specified way I am. So his answer to, you know, can I be totally sincere, for example, is sincerity itself would be a form of bad faith because it would be pretending that there is something that I, as a human being, am, the way a rock is a rock, and that's not what it is to be a human being. Now, that gets it into a heady realm of philosophy, but it shows you how you can start from these concrete descriptions of phenomena that we're all familiar with and get to some very deep and interesting, challenging philosophical questions.
And there's no rule that we can use to determine whether someone is authentic or not. There is no rule, there's no absolute standard that we can rely upon to say, yes, you are acting in good faith as opposed to bad faith. It's individualized, it's ambiguous, it changes from day to day, let alone from person to person.
Now, Sartre would go even further, and he would say that to claim that you're in good faith is a form of bad faith, because you're saying that there's a technical term, but he needs to use it, an essence, that is, of what you are. You're fundamentally this as opposed to being that. And he says that's the whole distinctive feature of a human being. Human beings are free, and as free, they can choose or not with a whole range of identities that they can have. So the question of I need to find out who I am is a very misleading question. The question that I want to find out who I am is better put as the question I have to decide who I want to be, at least from a Sartrean existentialist point of view.
Okay, and that's a really key shift, because I know that there are people who are listening, and certainly there are partisans in the philosophical profession who have criticisms of continental philosophy, and what many of them are going to say is, well, yeah, but okay, so where am I now? What do I have? I don't have anything to walk away from. There's nothing in my hand. There's no standard. There's no criteria. What does this give us? And when we end up with this question of, you know, what do I want to be? Mm-hmm. How does that help us direct our lives and our relationships in a way that is more useful, or I should say differently useful, than something like the Golden Rule?
Well, I mean, of course, Sartre may not be right, and there's a lot of argument we have to have about his position. But what it opens up is a possibility, anyway, of thinking about ourselves as radically free. Now, he may be wrong about this.
And that means absolutely free to be anything we want to be, no matter what.
Yeah, right. The example I use with my students is this. Say we're sitting in my class and are listening to me lecture, and I say, you know, I think about it. Here's what Sartre is saying. Right now, you're here you're in South Bend, Indiana at Notre Dame. There's a blizzard. It's horrible weather. You've got finals coming up. You're sick of all of this. You can simply get up right now, walk out of this classroom, thumb a ride out to Southern California and be a beach bum for the rest of your life. You can do that. And they'll all say, well, no, I can't. I got finals coming up. Well, the point is, if you think hard enough about it, you can blow all that off. You can radically transform yourself. And there's a certain titillation, at least, and a certain truth, actually, about that, right? I mean, you and I could stop talking on this radio show right now and say, hey, we're going off and we're going to become explorers of the South Pole and just leave and abandon our families and everything and do that. Now, you might say, well, that's stupid. You're not going to do that. Well, okay, you're not going to do it, but Sartre agrees with that, but you're not going to do it because that's what you choose. And you choose. And you could choose otherwise. And there's a kind of a lie we tell ourselves where we say we must behave in these sorts of ways, when what we really mean is I'm choosing to behave in these certain ways. Now, that could be of great practical significance. So just realize that, you know, I'm staying with this job. I'm staying with this partner. I'm sticking to this cause, not because it's impossible for me to do otherwise in any meaningful sense, but because I'm choosing to do it. That's something Sartre can be, that can be a very practical and interesting and powerful lesson for us at different times from a philosopher like Sartre.
And this is, again, one of the central questions of the modern world in the second half of the 20th century. What does it mean to be accountable for something? Starting from the Nuremberg trials and, you know, you did something because you were told to do so, from to these days, whose fault is it that you're poor? Whose fault is it that you had an affair? Going back to the Clinton example, one of the tensions that Tubin talks about in his book is, yes, there were all these people who wanted to get Clinton, but he still had the affair. And so he's responsible for making himself subject to their challenges. And so this question of what it means to be accountable is really one of the great questions of our lives today.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, and I think philosophy in the existential mode raises that question. But, you know, a lot of analytic philosophy has raised that question, too. Particularly work about, as you mentioned before, justice and such, and what do we owe one another. And think about Peter Singer's work on do we have a duty to give up virtually all of our luxuries and use the money that we would have spent, say, on our flat-screen TV and our latest DVD and so on, to support people, say, from dying from hunger, people who are living in foreign countries that we don't even know. Singer's made this very striking case that there's an obligation we have to give up almost all the luxuries of our lives, because obviously it's better that we give those up than that all sorts of people die of hunger, for example. I'm just saying there's an analytic philosopher who's given these same kind of existential challenges as in another context someone like Sartre does.
We have about 1 minute more, and we have another question from Minot, which is asking, is this all just a matter of style? Is this a rhetorical distinction, or is there something more substantive going on here?
I think it is more than just style. I mean, there is style, but I think there is substantive differences in the way these philosophers approach things. And particularly, I would say, the difference between analytic philosophers and the French philosophers from 1960 on that I've been talking about, that I talked about earlier, is this. The analytic philosophers stick with the common sense concepts that we have and the common sense truths, and they try to build on them by standard logical reasoning. The French philosophers, and much of the continental tradition tries to do this, but not all of it, they're not so much interested in probing what's implied by the common sense truths and concepts that we've got. They're rather interested in going beyond, transcending, developing new concepts that challenge and perhaps even undermine the everyday concepts of everyday life. So there, I think, you get a huge substantive difference in what they're trying to do.
This question of French philosophy also speaks to different environmental concerns, different histories. My understanding is that these questions of accountability really are responses to the French reaction to World War II and switching sides and collaborating and all this kind of stuff. Is that where you – do you also see this as coming from that puzzle, or do you see these questions coming from somewhere else?
Well, continental philosophy certainly developed before that. It might be – well, I mean, the origin is certainly as early as Husserl in Germany, and this is, you know, back in the first decade of the 20th century. So it's not totally connected with this, although even Husserl, in an anticipatory sort of way, speaks very often about a crisis in kind of an existential crisis, I think even you could say, in European history. Certainly in the French, on the French scene, though, it is true that there are two big factors, the disillusionment of a first generation in the wake of the First World War, which they saw as simply discrediting the generation that preceded it and rejecting the rationalistic, highly conceptualized sort of philosophy that generation carried out. That's your people like Sartre and Merleau-Ponty and Camus in another mode. They felt that just there had to be a kind of philosophy that was much more connected with the immediately lived world of real problems. As Sartre says, we need a philosophy that puts us into the marketplace, into the crossroads of the city. And he, when he read Husserl, oddly, he thought that gives it to us because it's this philosophy of experience that takes us back to the things the way they are in the lived world. Now, interestingly, the next generation, the people who came of age in the 1960s, and I'm thinking about Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida, Gilles Deleuze, people like that, that was in a similar way a reaction to what they saw as the failure of the previous generation. That is, the generation that had lived through and fought World War II, and then they felt didn't give us resources for dealing with the post-World War II world. And so Foucault, for example, has long discussions, especially in interviews that are very interesting, about how we just had to find a whole new way of living, a whole new way of thinking. We couldn't be guided by the given experience of the immediate experience of the world because we had to build new concepts that would take us beyond that. So in that sense, I think, yeah, the history makes a huge difference.
So does that make it difficult to talk to people with different histories, whether it's Spanish philosophy or American philosophy, or even, you know, if you know, the French and the Germans, different perspectives on World War II, to say the least, mm-hmm. and certainly World War I, which you were talking about. A lot of these philosophers talk about the inability to communicate and the difficulties in getting an idea across. Is that the consequence of different histories and different experiences, or is something else going on there?
Well, I think this is endemic in the human condition. I mean, remember that you can certainly get that kind of thinking from these Europeans out of their heavily existential history of all the brutality and the violence of the wars and dislocations. But on the other hand, the notion of irreconcilable differences and incommensurability and inability to communicate is a huge theme in Anglo-American analytic, that is to say, philosophy of science, right, with Thomas Kuhn, somebody we hadn't mentioned before. But Kuhn brings in this whole idea out of an analysis of what? Not out of world wars or existential angst, but out of the practice of science, and indeed physical science, physics in particular, that we get experiences out of that of an inability or a high level of difficulty in communicating with one another and incommensurability between various ways of thinking. So I think this is an issue that comes up all the time. And I think the big thing is this, and I think all the philosophers on both sides in the end realize it, it doesn't do to just make the cop-out of saying, well, you can't communicate with certain people. It's that it's always hard to communicate, but you also are obligated to keep trying to communicate. And there's got to be such things as partial communication. There's got to be such a thing as maybe understanding without total translation, as the way Kuhn used to talk about it. I think this has been a theme that you have found on both sides of the Atlantic in this continental analytic division.
And what's interesting about that is that you're really creating a moral imperative out of a fact, right? We have trouble communicating. Sometimes we can't communicate, but there is still this moral obligation to try and to do the best you can given the limited information that you have.
Yeah, and I say it's more than a moral obligation. It's just something that human beings are going to do. We're always going to try to communicate. I mean, even the rival blue state, red state bloggers who are screaming obscenities at one another, I mean, they think somebody's listening that they're going to get through to, right, in some way or another. So that's almost a zero degree of an effort at communication, but that's what they're still doing.
That's a really interesting observation because, of course, right, when someone decides that they just can't communicate, they shut down. They stop writing. They stop publishing. But the people
right.
who are screaming,
that's right.
they just
right.
think that if they scream louder, people will hear them, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, every time any of us post blogs on The Stone for the Times, we get really good comments from very literate, intelligent, interesting people. But there's always some person – who is usually very literate and intelligent, who says, I don't understand this. Philosophy is a complete waste of time. I don't see why you guys keep writing this stuff. It's really stupid. And it makes no sense. Well, and you think, yeah, okay, but, you know, you're trying to tell us this, right? if you really didn't care, you wouldn't read it. You wouldn't even know it's here, and you certainly wouldn't write responses to it.
About 6 months ago, we had Michael Walter on the show, and we talked about war. And in the monologue, I talked about there was this woman who, 3 episodes in a row, she somehow ended on our mailing list, would write me emails and say, you know, philosophy is stupid. Academics don't know anything about it. But she wrote me 3 times in
three
a
times.
Row.
Yes,
you
right.
know, and so she, clearly she wanted some sort of conversation. And there's also this conversation that one has with oneself. You know, I never thought about it in this context before, but one of my favorite Emerson essays is called Walking. And he talks about the experience of walking and the difference between walking and sauntering and the way
yeah.
that we open ourselves to all of these things in nature that we don't see. And I never thought about this way because this is really, to a certain sense, a continental, a phenomenological approach to things. And so mm-hmm. it really isn't just France and Germany and Italy. The term, as you said very early on, the term continental is misleading.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah. No, that's an interesting theme. Foucault actually talks about that one place because Baudelaire, the poet, has discussions about that walking, the guy who just walks around town and observes, and Foucault makes use, philosophical use of that analogy too. So you're in good company.
Well, and I'm honored. It's the first time in my life I've ever been compared, I don't know, compared to Foucault, at least in the same sentence.
Yeah.
But, you know, it... Does it get frustrating? I mean, you've really had a foot in both camps, and
yeah.
you've done political philosophy. You have that wonderful book, Pragmatic Liberalism, and then you have the stuff on Foucault and 20th century philosophy. Do you get frustrated with this categorization and the battle, or is it something that how do you feel about that all?
Well, I like to go back and forth, that's for sure. You mentioned Pragmatic Liberalism and the Critique of Modernity, which is basically a book about Alistair MacIntyre and Richard Rorty and Charles Taylor. And I remember explicitly when I decided to write that. I had just finished doing all sorts of work on continental philosophy, especially the French people. I'd written on Foucault. I'd written a lot of studies on him and other people like Derrida and Habermas and so on. And I said, you know, I'm going to sit down and I am going to spend a year reading philosophers that are clear, interesting immediately. I'm not feeling like I'm swimming up a river of glue when I go from one sentence to another. I'm going to read people I really enjoy reading in a straightforward sort of way. So I said, I'm going to take these three guys that I thought were models of good, exciting, accessible philosophy, and I'm going to write a book about them. Now, when I got through with that, I thought, well, I better go back and look at these continental guys again. So right now my mode is that I have been, in a way, overdosed on the continental mode, having just written a book about what I call thinking the impossible. And, you know, you spend a couple of years trying to think the impossible with Derrida and Heidegger and so on, and you're going to get a little weary. So now I think I'm ready for clear water of analytic philosophy for a while. But I think I need both of them. But one thing I have learned is that when I first started out on this, I was one of these bridge builders and saying, we could just, you know, if Quine would read Heidegger and Heidegger would read Quine, and it could all be doing one project. I don't believe that's true at all. No, I think, as you had said, these are two different parts of our soul. You're not going to reconcile them. They're just going to have to be able to keep in some sort of contact with one another. But they're two different ways of doing this very important project of philosophy.
And this leads to another question. And then I want to ask you something that's completely irrelevant. But in about 3-4 episodes, we're going to have a conversation with this historian of science named Jan Galinsky and talk about the history of constructivism in science. There's mm-hmm. this whole discussion within particularly continental philosophy, but not exclusively, that truth is a construction, that truth can't be revealed. Could you talk
right.
a little bit about what that means and the argument that there really is no such thing as truth, and when there is truth, that it's power and society and the stuff that Foucault talks about, but lots of other people do as well.
Yeah. I think it's a really big mistake to interpret Foucault in particular as some kind of a relativist about truth and saying that it reduces to power and so on. Well, he himself puts it nicely. He says, I have emphasized the distinction between power and knowledge. If I didn't think there were something called knowledge separate from power, I wouldn't have emphasized the distinction. I would only talk about power. So, there is truth. There is truth in some standard sort of way. Foucault's point has been, and I think it's a powerful one, many things that are presented as truth are simply the artifacts, the constructions of power systems. That is certainly true. And one question we have to always ask is, what is it that we need to accept because we have no particular alternative to accept it because it just, the world hits us with it as being true? And what is it that's presented to us by our society or by our teachers or even by ourselves as the truth and not to be questioned, when in fact it is really just the something that contingently originated in certain historical, accidental historical circumstances. So I don't think it's a path to skepticism, but I think it's not a path to global skepticism. You know, we don't know anything, everything's just power relations, but it's a path to certain very useful, what I would call regional skepticism, that is being questioning a certain particular science, say the alleged, the scientific pretensions of psychiatry, for example, or of maybe a sociobiology or the philosophies of education that are around in the world. That's a good kind of healthy skepticism, which we could use the kind of Foucault or Nietzschean analysis that they call genealogy to dissolve. But I don't think it works as a general skepticism to eliminate all truth and all knowledge.
Well, that's also going to be a great segue for our listeners, because not next month, but the month after that, we are going to be talking with Deirdre McCloskey about economics, and we're going to ask her whether economics is a science. So I want to ask you, this is totally disconnected from the rest of the conversation, but I have you here, and I want to ask you, the New York Times blog, The Stone, it's a big deal. It's you know, it gets a huge audience. It's for general population, the readership of the New York Times, you know, that's massive worldwide. How's that going? How is writing philosophy for a general audience, how's the response? It's internet only, and you mentioned the responses. How's that going?
I think it's going great. I mean, I get a tremendous amount out of it. I love doing it. What I've found particularly is that I'm finding less and less of a disconnect between professional philosophy thinking and writing and this more popular sort of thing. We often, I mean, I initially thought, well, there'll be this kind of popularization, and then there's my real work, so to speak. And of course, there's still a difference between writing, you know, articles for university presses and so on. And writing in The Stone. But I have found time and again that each side of that work illuminates the other. And it's not just that I'm drawing on and dumbing down my technical professional work for The Stone. It's also that I'm learning things from an attempt to speak to a more general audience. So I find that it's philosophically growing for me to do this kind of work. Well, to take this program we just did, I've learned all sorts of things that had never occurred to me before about these issues we've been talking about. So I think it's great that way. Now, one thing you learn if you read the comments, I don't know if you've read lots of the comments that are they're on mine, but any of the posts on The Stone. They don't give us a lot of quarter. A lot of people just they read what you have to say and they say, okay, well, here's what's wrong with that, and you know, so they're like professional philosophers are that way, for sure. So you don't get a lot of, oh, that was so great, you know. Especially if it's on controversial topics, if you write about religion or morality in particular, you really really get it. The other thing that's very interesting, and I've held it against the commenters, but I'm not so sure if I should. The first thing you notice when you initially post is this. You get like 200, 300, 400, 500 comments. You'll think, my God, this is great. Now I got all these people responding to what I had to say. Well, not exactly. I mean, for instance, the first thing I wrote was a piece about faith and philosophy. So it was about religious belief. That was over a year ago, I guess. And it got a huge amount of comments. But I bet 85% of the comments are the same as they would have been had my blog consisted simply of the sentence, what do you think about religion? That is, a lot of people just say, religion, here's my line. And then they write up, you know, really interesting stuff, but it doesn't engage especially with what the person who wrote the blog had actually brought out as issues. And I think that's okay, because what people are doing is just saying, hey, I got a chance to, you know, speak to the world about this thing. But I think one thing we all have to learn more about in terms of the blogosphere and the internet is to use it as a real instrument of communication, where we keep responding to one another and not using it as just a kind of a stimulus to the reflex of, here's my line on this. So that's one thing I think could be improved.
And that really is the rub, isn't it? I mean, to find a mechanism that allows us to engage in communication. We have a lot of listeners who talk to me afterwards or who send me email who say, this is all new to me. I love it. I wanted to ask a question, but I didn't know what to ask.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah, yeah. No, that's true. And maybe that's a good point. Maybe that's what's the difficulty with a lot of our commenters, that they think they're just coming into a conversation from the sideways and don't know what to say. So they'll say, well, here's what I think in my own terms, where they feel confident, which, of course, that's what we're doing too, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a parallel. There's a parallel between the analytic continental debate and the specialized general audience debate, because you can see it as two fundamentally different things, but they're really not.
No, that's right. Well, there's another connection between it too, because, you know, when the analytic continental distinction really starts up, I mean, not in those terms, but where the division starts coming in is basically with Kant's later philosophy, right? When he starts writing the critiques. And I always remember that Thomas Macaulay, the great historian, who was a polymath, he said this, that he was really distressed at Kant's critique of pure reason, because he said, everything else in philosophy before Kant, I, as Macaulay, as an educated man, I could read it. I could read Hume, I could read Locke, I could read Descartes, I could read Plato and Aristotle. He says, I can't read Kant. And so there's a sense in which philosophy before that point was pretty much, at least in the modern age and the medievals, there was a lot of technicality, but it was a popular medium, right? Even Hume, he writes the Treatise on Human Nature, and then says, well, that's really technical, and then nobody paid any attention to it, so he had to even write a review of it himself, and then he writes his treatises, or his essays, I'm sorry, the two essays, which are meant for popular consumption. So another way to track this continental analytic distinction is that there was a time when philosophy wasn't highly professionalized, as both the continental and the analytic worlds are, but spoke to a wider human community. And maybe the resources of the internet now are making it possible once more for us to get back to that kind of communication and make that be an important thing for philosophers as philosophers to do.
That's really interesting, and I taught a seminar last semester on Kant in the 19th century, and I had my undergraduates read about 200 pages of the critique, and now I get to tell them that somebody else thinks it's unreadable as well.
That's right, yeah.
Well, this has been wonderfully interesting, challenging, high energy. Gary Gutting, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Thank you, Jack. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking to Gary Gutting, and I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, and we'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back listening to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We've been talking about this division between analytic and continental philosophy, a division that sounds like it's a professional dispute, a matter for specialists alone. And I will admit that when I had this show in mind, there were a lot of people who said, look, this isn't going to come off. People aren't going to be interested in this obscure debate. But what I believe, and what I think really comes out in our discussion today, is that this is the debate of this century. This is the debate of trying to figure out exactly how we are to think about the world and how we are to think about ourselves. It's a debate about accountability. It's a debate about authenticity. These are the questions of politics right now. These are the questions of the Republican primary. These are the questions of the Clinton presidency. These are the questions of husbands and wives and children everywhere. What do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to be when you die? How do you want people to think about you? And how much of that is in your control? The other aspect of it is, how do we want people to talk about us and describe us? Can Jack be described as an argument or a proposition? Or does my life have to be portrayed in some form of literature to talk about not the simplistic things divided up piece by piece, but rather the whole me with the tensions, with the ambiguities? And I'm not special in this regard. Every single person is a story, and every single experience is laden with meaning and with history and with complex emotions. Can we describe these things by just using simple language, common sense terms, as Gary Gutting called them? Or do we have to create new structures, new ideas, new visions to take us past these limitations and this argument? The debate between the analytics and the continentals does not have a winner. One is not better than the other. One is not superior than the other. It is instead that they work in tandem to describe different aspects of the human experience, to analyze different aspects of the human experience. And as we do that, we ask questions about love. We ask questions about justice. We ask questions about morality. We ask questions about beauty. All of the great questions which may not be answered, but the thrill, the interest, the excitement is in the exploration. We as human beings are explorers, and we can explore simply and we can explore complexly. And if we do one, only one, rather than the other, we are limiting ourselves just like we limit ourselves if we only look at one school of philosophy. This has been Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.